I'm here in Dartmouth Square on Dublin's south side, the location of Luke Kelly's final home, a stately Victorian red brick property, which he bought as a haven of rest from his non-stop touring. The house overlooks Dartmouth Square, where after a long lie-in each morning, I can imagine him feasting his eyes on the manicured lawns and maybe listening to the uplifting sound of children playing. And on a calm day, he might even have heard the sound of the water flowing in the nearby Grand Canal. This place has changed so little since Luke lived here. It's not hard to imagine him nearby in the local tavern, sitting back and having a chat.
My name is Luke Kelly.
But his early life was in a very different setting, on the other side of the Liffey, by the banks of the Royal Canal. Actually, it was a song about the Royal Canal that set Luke on his life's path.
It was quite by accident, actually. You know, I was sitting in a pub in Newcastle on Tyne. It's a great singing area in England, Geordieland. And, you know, I used to frequent jazz clubs, and some character said, well, the folk song club is starting tonight, I'm going along. You know, I said, well, can I come along with you? And away I went, you know, and I was waiting to pay in, and there was a crowd of English people, surprisingly enough, singing the old triangle, you know?
They were
making the most wonderful sounds, singing the most wonderful harmonies, natural, extemporaneous, and I felt it straight away, and I haven't been at a jazz club since, and I've been singing folk songs ever since.
Of the Royal Canal.
Johnny Reavy in Newcastle, who sang the old triangle. We left Newcastle and we travelled, hitching our way down through the Lake District and the beautiful, very beautiful in the north of England, heading for Birmingham. I was to be best man at my brother's wedding in Birmingham. And he had a guitar and banjo, he played both. So I was literally carrying the banjo for him. And he showed me the basic licks, the basic strokes. And then he gave it to me. So that's how it started, really. All accidents, all real. I haven't learned much more about it since that.
And the old triangle could go jingle, jangle all along the banks of the Royal Canal.
Luke was a man who had many gifts, the most obvious a unique voice and a shock of copper curls. But we will also uncover an insatiable thirst for knowledge and a will to help his fellow man that made him stand out from the crowd. As we walk on the streets where he lived in our capital city, we learn how his life was crammed with colour and solid friendships. And we will also discover how his strong personality can, to this day, evoke emotional reactions 30 years after his passing. This is the story of a man with a voice that death cannot still.
I've been a wild rover for many's the year, and I've spent all me money on whiskey and beer. But now I'm returning with gold in great store, and I never will play the wild rover no more. And it's gone, nay, never. No, nay, never, no more will I play the wild rover. No, never, no more. I went into an alehouse I used to frequent, and I told the landlady me money was spent. I asked her for credit, she answered me nay. Such a custom as yours I can have every day, and it's no nay never. No nay never, no more will I play the wild over. No never, no more.
The Dubliners, Ronnie Drew, Barney McKenna, Kieran Burke, John Sheehan and Luke Kelly.
Well, the popular story, the popular fiction, and I think it is a fiction, is that Luke Kelly, the literary one I was called, was reading a book in the corner. It happened to be James Joyce's Dubliners. And so I took my nose out of the book for a second and said, listen, we're all from Dublin. We call ourselves the Dubliners. But I actually did say we call ourselves the Dubliners, but it wasn't because I was reading James Joyce at the time. It was just we're all from Dublin. Why not the Dubliners? Which I think is a lucky name. I think it's a very good name. You know, we did know that we had a unique talent in Ronnie Drew's voice. A unique talent in Barney McKenna, the banjo player, because he's the best banjo player maybe in the world, you know. And John is a quiet one. John is, you might even say, conservative. You know, he's not hurt by being called names like that, but he is a conservative individual.
He was quite excited about the sound of the fiddle and how it blended with Barney's banjo and so on and backing the songs.
First impressions, John?
First impressions, red-faced, unruly mop of hair, full of energy, brash, friendly, argumentative, threw the head back and an amazing voice came out, and that was Lou Kelly, nobody else like him.
Down the mines, no sunlight shines, those pits, they're black as hell. In mud and slime, they do their time. It's Paddy's prison cell. And they curse the day they travel far, then drown their tears with a jar. So make way for the Molly Maguires. They're drinkers, they're liars, but they're men. Make way for the Molly Maguires. You'll never see.
The Dubliners started their career by singing not far from here in O'Donoghue's in Merrion Row, and then, stretching their vista, played in other venues in the city, and even later in the pubs and festivals of Ireland. Their impact was such that UK management, in the form of a gentleman called Phil Solomons from Belfast, who had had chart success with Ruby Murray and the Bachelors, became interested, and the result was a single release called Seven Drunken Nights, and an appearance for the unlikely lineup on Top of the Pops.
Oh, as I went home on Monday night, as drunk could be, I saw a horse outside the door where my old horse should
be. But that world wasn't for them. So they contacted Irish manager Noel Pearson. Noel remembers.
1970, I think, Brendan Behan's last play was Richard's Cork Leg, and I did it with them at the Peacock. And then it was a big hit, and we went to the Olympia, and then we went to the Royal Court in London, and then I was with them from about 70 to 81, yeah.
Noel Pearson, having always admired the music and talent of songwriter Phil Coulter, decided to introduce him to the music of the Dubliners. It proved to be a potent, creative union for Phil and Luke.
I jumped at it. I mean, I didn't need any persuasion at all, because, I mean, I'd loved the music. So going through the material was interesting, to say the least. And one of my abiding recollections of Luke was that in the early days, I think it might have been, I'm sure it was actually in the very first album, and we're going through songs, and he was singing bits of this, that, and all. You have to remember that Luke had a great knowledge of folk music. He had spent years doing the circuit in the UK, you know, so he hung out with all those British folkies, and all the Ewan McCall songs, the Ian Campbell songs. Kelly was the guy that uncovered them and had them in his pack.
I met my love by the gasworks croft. Dreamed a dream by the old canal. I kissed my girl by the factory wall. Dirty old town, dirty old town.
clouds are drifting across the moon. Cats are prowling on their beat. Springs a girl from the streets at night. Dirty old town, dirty old town.
With hundreds and thousands in their fan base, tours of Ireland were always a must for Luke and the Dubliners. With variety for the audience in mind, Noel Pearson engaged the young comedian Noel Ginnity as a warm-up act. Noel recalls.
Noel Pearson took an interest in me and he started to look after me a bit and sent me with them on the concert tours and whatever. They had a big concert.
So you were the warm-up, were you?
Yeah, I was at the warm-up, yeah.
Okay.
But I had two jobs as time went on. I had to stay on until I saw the whole lot of them at the side of the stage because...
keep her going.
They could be putting their pants on or looking for them.
Until
yeah.
There was a five.
So keep on going, Patsy. Yeah. So I had to put, especially in places like the Albert Hall, I definitely had to make sure that they were all assembled and get the high sign from the fellow McGowan that was promoting the Albert Hall at the time, that they were all there, because they could be looking for the guitar or the capo or this or that.
I'm going to make a good sharp man.
I met my love. Indeed, Luke had met his love. He saw her first and knew. Luke fell in love fully and completely twice in his life. He spent his final years with German-born Madeline Seiler. But as a young man, his heart was stolen by American-born actress and singer Deirdre O'Connell.
In New York, I had a wonderful theatrical education, for which I will always be grateful. You know, considering that, you know, I came from working class people and we had no money. So, you know, it was an amazing opportunity. And I was good enough and innocent enough in a way to get this scholarship that just, you know, paid every bill. So for 4.5 years, I worked full time, see, which isn't an opportunity that people have here. If they train twice a week, they consider themselves damn lucky. Whereas I did 6 days a week for 4.5 years, but it was bliss. And that was before going to the actor's studio. You had that behind you before you even went to, let's say, a professional studio.
Deirdre had a dream. It was to found a theatre in Ireland that would teach the Stanislavski method acting technique. Luke and Deirdre sang together at the Newport Jazz Festival, spending time with Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, and came home with their savings. They started their search for premises.
We were nomads for 4 years. And then we went out scouting, you know, by which time I'd made enough money in New York. And Luke threw me the few bob. So between us and then everyone in the company knew a friend or two, we got the 3,000 together. Imagine, it only took £3,000 to build it.
One of Deirdre's first students was Sabina Coyne, now the wife of our president, Michael D. Higgins. Sabina fondly remembers the young lovers.
I met him through Deirdre. I was a student of hers in the Stanislavski studio when she came over from America. And she was a singer too. And she met Luke in O'Donoghue's, where the folk singing and all that new movement and ballads was taking place. This was 1963. And I think she had just come over and they had met. And I think it was... more or less love at first sight.
I was going to say, only a woman could ask you this. Was it love at first sight?
No, I think he was smitten with Deirdre straight away. Now, she was absolutely the
gorgeous, most
striking woman in Dublin. She really was.
Yes.
That beautiful, golden skinned with golden hair, always dressed in black. And she just had an aura and a presence on the street. I mean, people just looked at her and... All I remember of that was her, you know, little images that come to you now those years later of her being really pleased that Luke got all dressed up and was kind of wooing him for under the window of where she was staying.
Singing under the window?
Yeah, well, yeah, well he was singing that, you know. So I think that endeared him to her.
Dusk is drawn and the green man's horn is wreathed in rains of fog. Shira sails his boat till morn across the starry bog. A land van o' the paly moon has ringed her caspian dew. To hear the sad sweet tune I sing, oh love, to you.
And then, of course, they both had such a background in theatre. In, you know, she had all the drama. She was an actress on and off Broadway, teacher, and had come over with a mission of for Ireland because she loved the place to bring the
studio. It's quite innovative
studio
at that time.
Oh, it was. Mm. She brought it as a yeah mission to bring the Stanislavski
yes
system there. And of course, then she was quite a genius, and he, of course, was completely unique, and it's this great, great talent in his own. So I think they were. They had all of those things in common. They were just dedicated. They were great artists, and they I'm were from then on. They mm were like they were the love of each other's lives, you know.
I met Luke originally through the Focus Theatre. Deirdre O'Connell had established the Stanislavski studio, and Sabina Coyne, who's now my wife, was one of the very early people who joined Deirdre. And from time to time, as the rehearsals would be going on, I was calling to see Sabina, or Luke would be arriving after a gig or whatever to meet Deirdre. And then we knew each other then, that time. In those years, Dublin seemed to me now to be have been a very small place. So you might start off the evening in somebody's flat, but by the end of the evening, you'd have met quite a few people. Then I was meeting Luke separately at events which would have been trade union protests and work. I was very, very early involved in the first amnesty groups and in the anti-apartheid groups. And Luke and Noel Brown and I would have met on occasions in Mrs. Gahey's, I remember, upstairs. Mark Gahey would be downstairs and Noel would be resting before going to a meeting. And we would, so we were meeting in several different ways. And then as our lives went on, Sabine and I were married in 1974, and both Deirdre and Luke were at the wedding. I got the impression from him that he was always looking for a perfect song. But I got also the impression, I didn't have as many conversations with him, obviously, as Sabina would have had. But I do remember very clearly, and Sabina would ask me, did you ask him yet about making the recordings? You know, these are for the songs of that time. We would have all these songs as we were out on the streets and so forth. But it would always come back. He'd say to me, why don't you contact Ewan McCall? And he'd be the man for that, you know.
And I knew McCall because I spent a lot of time in his company in London when I left the Dubliners for 2 years in the very early days. I went over simply to be in McCall's circle. He had this weekly, wouldn't call it a school, wouldn't call it a class, a gathering of like-minded people, if you like. And it wasn't a songwriting school or class. It was simply to talk about the songs, you know, Scottish traditional songs, English traditional songs, and Irish traditional songs. And so when, as he was writing them, we, you know, the group of us who were there, you know, had first bite at them, as it were, you know. Shoals of Herring is another we wrote.
With our nets and gear, we're faring on the wild and wasteful ocean. It's out there. Hunt the bunny shoals of the herring. Oh, it was a fine and a pleasant day. Out of Yarmouth Harbour I was faring, as a cabin boy on a sailing lugger. Following the shoals of
herring. 1973, how I got to know him, we did Jesus Christ Superstar, and he was a frustrated actor. He really wanted to be an actor, and we put him in as Herod, and he loved the lyrics, "Oh, you think you're the Christ, the great, walk across my swimming pool," and he did that, but he was shocked at the amount of rehearsal. And these two girls, two dancers, Jerry Kelly and
Nikki and Jerry,
yeah, were teaching him to dance, and he couldn't get the steps. And on top of that, on the first night, his teeth flew out as he was trying to sing the song. Of course, we all broke up. It was just hilarious, you know. And I think he lasted a week.
So if you are the Christ, you're the great Jesus Christ. Proof to me that you're divine. Change my water into wine. That's all you need do, and I'll know it's all true. Come on, King of the Jews.
With all of those guys, they were all dragged out of folk groups or show bands or cabaret acts or whatever it might be. Theatrical experience, zero.
Zero.
Theatrical discipline, less than zero.
And Phil didn't see the need for it either.
Chaos. Complete chaos. I remember I was over in Dublin with Pearson doing the casting. Like, you see, okay, Kelly was one of them. I thought, well, he loved it. He volunteered right away. He wanted a piece of this action. There was no way, if Superstar was going on, he wasn't going to be in it. So we started auditioning members of the chorus. So we'd get guys coming in, putting the music on, they're going, "Buy the shot, cut to the races, 'twas on the market." Next, somebody else came in, "Love you, dears." Next. There was no pool of guys who could kind of sing pop music who had any kind of experience on the stage. I mean, Luke used to turn up to rehearse again with the eyes sunk, you know, like piss holes in the snow, as they say back here. To get him to sing was I used to feel sorry for him even when he stood on the line and sang a song. When I had nursed him through, "You are the Christ, you're the great..."
That's half fun. Gear themselves to that, Mike. Sing towards that, Mike.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
"So you are the Christ, you're the great Jesus Christ. Prove to me that you're no fool, walk across my swimming..."
Anyway, after that I said to Luke, "Look, you're not in good shape. I'll tell you what, I know you guys are on a break now at the end of the month. I'm going up to the Great Southern Hotel in Bundoran for a week, the first week of August. I go up there every year. The kids, why don't you come up?" And he said, "Yeah, I might do that." No, I never believed that he would. But having lunch in the dining room in the Great Southern Hotel in Bundoran, this banger pulls into the car park. And to my amazement, out gets Luke and a pal of his, Tommy Weddick, a chef, big guy. The two of them get out. And I'm astounded, there is Kelly. And he stayed for two or three days. And through the days, he was playing in the swimming pool with my kids, diving in and doing bombs and playing water polo, etc. And just acting like their uncle. And Kelly, the man, there's a completely different side of Kelly. Completely relaxed, playing with the kids, just being like a big child. I treasure that memory,
"Thank you for today's, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days I won't forget. forget a single day, believe me. I bless the light, I bless the light that lights on you, believe me. Now you're gone, you're with me every single day, believe me. Days I'll remember all my life. Days when you can't see wrong from right. You took my life, but then I knew that very soon you'd leave me. But it's all right, now I'm not frightened of this world, believe me. That lights on you, believe me. And though you're gone, you're with me every single day, believe me.
Luke's quest for the perfect song was helped along by three very different writers who all recognised his uniqueness: Ewan McCall, Phil Coulter and Patrick Kavanagh.
On the Raglan Road, on an autumn day, I met her first and knew that her dark hair could weave a snare that I might one day rue.
We were in a pub. We won't name the pub. I don't suppose it's allowed on television. Well, it was in the Bailey anyway. And he was singing in his own peculiar manner, and so was I, in my own peculiar manner. And he said, I've got a song for you. And he said, you should sing Raglan Road.
On Raglan Road, of an autumn day, I saw her first and anew. That her dark hair would weave a snare that I might one day rue. I saw the danger and I passed along the enchanted. Be a fallen leaf at the dawning of day. On Grafton Street in November we trip lightly along the ledge of a deep ravine where can be seen the worth of passion's pledge, the queen of hearts still making tarts, and I not making hay. Oh, I loved too much. And by such is happiness thrown away.
He was a man of very strongly held opinions, Max. You know, from a songwriting point of view, he had that great integrity. And what history has proven that after he did Scorn at His Simplicity, you know that Luke refused to sing it in Dubliners' gigs. He didn't want to trivialise the song,
yeah,
I know that, you know, and he felt that maybe, you know, in the midst of a rather a bousy Dubliners gig was not the place for Scorn at His Simplicity, which I really, really appreciated, you know.
So take me to the moment you sang it for him, because I know it was rather special.
Well,
The courage to sing the song for, as a composer to an artist is, I mean, a lot of, you know, composers listen and go, will I do this? Will I jump in?
Yeah, because particularly with that song, because that was a particularly personal song. And, you know, Down syndrome kids are special little kids, you know what I mean? And they have such a lot to give. They're very loving. They're very musical and very affectionate. But but at the time, when I wrote the song, I didn't know that. I was still feeling a bit confused, I suppose, and a bit disappointed and whatever. So the song really did, I suppose, help me come to terms with it. And I do remember playing it to Luke in a quiet moment, which the quiet moments were very hard to come by and with, when you were rehearsing with the Dubliners. But I knew just by the look on his face that he realised that I had crossed that divide that he'd always been nagging me to do. Had I not made that transition to be able to do Scorn Not His Simplicity as a result of Kelly's nagging, years later, I wouldn't have been able to do The Town I Love So Well.
So you sang it for him, and when he sang it for you, did you go, yes, that's the sound I want?
Yeah, I mean, again, the piano was featured in it, you know, I mean, that bump bump was very important. When I ran it through,
it was like a heartbeat, isn't it?
Kelly said, yeah, 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 keep that. I was just kind of, doodling around the chords and he stopped right away. Yeah, 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 Kelly.
Do you know what strikes me, Phil? You know the way that brings my heart in straight away for a deep meaning song? See the child, the first three words hook me in incredibly as well.
Yeah.
That's very powerful, that entry.
That, well, the song was quite a cathartic experience for me, really, you know. I do recall that it was painful.
See the child with the golden hair but eyes that show the emptiness inside. Do we know? Can we understand just how he feels, or have we really tried? See him now, as he stands alone and watches children play a children's game. Simple child, he looks almost like the others, yet they know he's not the same. Scorn not his simplicity, but rather try to love him all the more. Scorn not his simplicity, oh no.
So take me to the birth of The Town I Love So Well then.
Well, that's a curious one, really, because after Scorn Not His Simplicity, I happened to be in Derry on the weekend that internment was introduced. Now, that was traumatic, to say the least. So there were guys in my acquaintance, guys who were at school with me, who were dragged out of bed, who were no more terrorists or paramilitaries than I was, but that's the way it was. As the situation in the north deteriorated, and you know, I'd go back regularly and see what was happening in Derry, and see that pall of gloom descend on everybody, and what had been like a very musical, fun-loving place became very, very, very gloomy. There was these army patrols and army checkpoints and helicopters overhead. It was a different place. And it gradually came to me that this is crying out for a song that should kind of try and give voice to all of this. And I always knew at the back of my mind, I have the boy for this song. Always, always Kelly's voice was in my mind. As often happens, I was forced into a deadline. They were doing a run in a working men's club in Sheffield. The hotel was not a glamorous hotel. It was like some kind of two-star.
Earthy. It was earthy.
It was budget would be the word before it was thought of as budget hotels. Anyway, I'm in a room that has an uninterrupted view of the car park. A twin-bedded room, I remember, with like kind of dark green wallpaper. And it's just all, of, you know, the joys of being on the road. Anyway, down he came. You know, with a fold of flesh under the eyes, the usual look, Kelly look. And he sat down in one of the twin beds. I sat on this twin bed, produced my guitar, and sang The Town I Love So Well. I remember this, Maxi, like as if it was last week. I played the guitar, sang the song with my eyes firmly closed, because I didn't want to see his reactions as I was going through the song. In case I would see the odd frown or the odd eyebrow raised and think to myself, oh Christ, I've got it wrong. Because that would have thrown me, you know. I was kind of protective about the song. It was a new baby that I was unveiling for the first time.
And it was important how he felt.
This was a critical test. Yeah. I mean, this was the acid test. I knew if it got past Kelly, then I was doing okay.
Yeah.
And the most I hoped for that he would say at the end, yeah, it's okay. So I finished the song, and it's a long song, as you'll know. Got to the end. I can only pray for a bright, brand new day in the town I love. So ding, 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 ding. Last chord. Opened my eyes and looked across at Kelly, and there were tears in his eyes.
Wow.
Even now, Jesus, wow. Giving me goose pimples. Even
30 years on,
now.
Yeah.
Christ, caught me by surprise. Eh?
Yes, yes. But that I'm emotional myself because that intimacy, that respect,
shit.
That respect is there.
Wow. That took me by surprise.
You want a tissue?
Wow. Wow. It was, it was one of those special moments, you know.
In my memory, I will always see the town that I have loved so well, where our school played ball by the gas yard wall, and we laughed the smoke and the smell. Going home in the rain, running up the dark lane, past the jail and down behind the fountain. Those were happy days in so many, many town I loved so well. Now the music's gone, but they carry on, for their spirit's been bruised, never broken. They will not forget, but their hearts are set on tomorrow and peace once again. For what's done is done, and what's won is won, and what's lost is lost and gone forever. I can only pray for a bright, brand new day in the town I love so well.
With the success of the songs written especially for him, Luke's career soared. But in his personal life, he was experiencing a disappointment and loneliness after the breakup of his marriage to Deirdre. One evening in Dublin, love struck for the second time. He met the woman who was to share the rest of his life, Madeline Zeiler. I asked her how she met him.
The first time I met Luke was in Grogan's, and I remember him basically like it was yesterday, walking in, and a friend of mine introduced us, and he looked at me very intensely and said, "Haven't we met somewhere before?" And I didn't know what to say. I didn't know who he was, and didn't know the Dubliners. I hadn't been in Ireland that long. I'd actually lived in Raglan Road, as it happens, would you believe? It certainly was quite a strong attraction.
Can I bring you to that dreadful time in Iceland?
A lot of people don't know about that particular... That was the beginning of his troubles, I suppose. Most people... associate the Opera House in Cork in 1980 with the beginning of Luke's problems with the brain tumour. But sometime before that, we were playing in Iceland in Reykjavik, and we flew up there the day before. And the next morning, Luke phoned my room and he says, "Where are we?" And I said, how do you mean, where are we? He said, where are we? I'm after looking out the window and there's all sort of foreign writing on the shops across the road. I haven't a clue where I am. And I said, we're in Reykjavik. Do you not remember we flew to Glasgow and got another flight from there up here yesterday? He says, no. He says, I just looked out of the bed there and I saw the duty-free bag lying on the floor, so I knew we were in some foreign part, but no recollection of the night before at all. And I explained the whole thing to him, what we were doing, where we were. And he said, oh, no, that's okay. And he was still a bit disorientated because when I came down for breakfast, he had his case down at the lobby ready to go home. And to me, that was the beginning of this problem with this brain tumour starting to manifest itself, you know.
But we weren't aware that it could be...
No, not at that stage, no.
Yeah.
So it didn't really manifest itself until we were doing this gig in the Opera House in 1980. And he had to leave the stage. He became dizzy and this terrible headache. And after the gig, we got him straight into University Hospital in Cork. And he was operated on there the next day, brain tumour. But it was one of these complicated tumours because it was deep-seated, deep-rooted within the brain. They couldn't fully remove the whole thing. So after a few months, it began to grow again. So he had two or three operations during the next 3 or 4 years. But determined to come back on stage again. So within about 2 months of the operation, he was back touring with us, you know, and determined to do it. And performing very well again within a short time, full of energy. And
Mannheim was the final one then.
That's right. That was in the autumn or the winter of 83, I think. And the same thing, very bad headache, had to leave the stage and couldn't perform. And he spent a couple of days in University Hospital there. And they referred him back to his surgeon here in Dublin. And that was very close to the end. He died a couple of months later, the end of January in 1984.
So that was around November time. Spent Christmas together. And then, of course, in January, he suddenly went into a coma.
And, was that in the house?
In the house.
And you were there?
Yeah, I was with him. I didn't know he had gone into a coma.
But you were there.
He
wasn't alone.
No, he actually was in good form earlier that day. Asked me, should we go to the cinema and what would I like to see? And we discussed that a bit and he had his breakfast. And then later when he wanted to get up, he just wasn't feeling right. And I just said, just relax for a while. And, you know, we still had time to go out and whatever. Check back up now and again on him. But then after a while, there was no response, and then I got really worried. So I actually ran to neighbours and asked him, because it was Saturday night and didn't know who to call, you know. Did they know a doctor nearby? And so anyway, eventually an ambulance came and brought him into hospital and basically never came out of the coma. And
no pain, I'd say.
Not anymore at that point, no. Because he was just, I mean, he was still breathing, the heart was beating. And I was with him when they said, you know, I mean, the heart was still very strong and there was no point. They had done a scan and there was no, I mean, even if he had woken up, you know, but he wasn't.
Inactivity.
Yeah, exactly, so... So I was there with him when he quietly, peacefully passed away in the hospital, And, I suppose life was really never the same after he went. What else can I say?
Of course, I got a great shock. I believed he was such a tough little cookie. I thought he'd battle that, like. I thought that was a temporary setback. I thought he was a great fighter on it. I thought, of course, you think some people are invincible, and I thought he was one of those, you know. I thought he was just a ball of muscle and energy and keep it going, Patsy job, you know. I didn't think anything as trivial as a tumour on his brain would kill Luke Kelly, you know. It's killed the person, but not the myth.
I was with him the day before he died, but my Uncle Jimmy down in Arden, County Limerick, he died just the day before Luke, so I had to go down to his funeral and play at it and so on. But on my way back on the radio that morning, I heard the news, Gay Byrne, and he played the Wild Rover, and I must say it was tears in my own eyes. But he died overnight, so I was then going from one funeral to another. I was coming back for Luke's funeral.
Now, I was talking to Noel Pearson in New York on the occasion of the death of Luke Kelly of the Dubliners, died last night.
I was living in America at the time, you know, and I was kind of 84, and I was finished with the Dubliners then. I was doing something in New York, and they called me, and that was it. I just came home for the funeral.
Your thoughts then? So were you surprised?
I was never surprised, no, because at the pace he lived was just... He wasn't, you know, the last couple of years of his life was pretty rough for him, you know.
Well, I knew because Deirdre had told me, because I remember a very kind of sad thing that he had said to her. You know, his hair was gone, and he said, "Will you just give me a little bunch of your hair now to put on here, you know," because she had the kind of the hair. So I went up to the funeral, and I remember it was such a sense of loss in Dublin. And again, it was in the same church in Whitehall. And the whole of Dublin really were there, all of the Dublin. Of course, the Dubliners were Ronnie Drew and John Sheehan and Barney. They were all devastated, you know. And I remember Siobhan McKenna coming up the side with the church with a big, big bunch of daffodils.
I unfortunately became then associated with sad events in a way, because I spoke at Luke's funeral and at the unveiling of the monument. What I think I take out of those, though, was I always loved meeting John Sheehan, mm-hmm. who speaks with such authenticity.
He loves
it
to this day.
He does.
Well, to me, it was like losing a brother, you know, because over the years, there was a great bond between us all. We'd have our arguments and fights that would last no longer than a couple of pints of Guinness and everything would be fine again. And it was really like losing a family member, you know. I felt it very deeply. A lot of the thoughts from the past, the great times we had together, the arguments, the celebrations and so on, they all came flashing back. And I was a lonely enough character driving all the way from Limerick back to Dublin on my own to get ready for Luke's funeral.
You and your thoughts.
Yes, yeah. But I suppose there's a certain consolation in listening to the rich legacy of stuff that he's left us.
For what died the sons of Roisin? Was it fame? For what died the sons of Roisin? Was it fame? For what flowed Ireland's blood and rivers that began when Brian chased the dame and did not cease nor has not ceased with the brave sons of 16. For what died the sons of Roisin? Was it fame? For what died the sons of Roisin? Was it greed? For what died the sons of Roisin? Was it greed? Was it greed that drove Wolf Tone to a pauper's death in a cell of cold, wet stone? Will German, French, or Dutch inscribe the epitaph of Emmet when we've sold enough of Ireland to be but strangers in it? For what died the sons of Roisin? Was it greed?
He was attending lectures at night, and he was going to classes on the history of socialism. He had attracted the attention of maybe the most brilliant Marxist intellectual of a group at that time, George Thompson. George Thompson would have been regarded as an iconic, magnificent intellectual figure in Eastern Europe at the time, and he was connected to Prague University. And he offered Luke a scholarship to go and study there. And Luke had a decision to make at that particular stage then, whether he would follow on in what he was deeply interested, because the way it was in that period, I remember I was in Manchester in 1968, and that period in the 1960s, there was kind of a wide church of the left that would have included different members of trade unions, labour groups, Young Communist League, Connolly movements, and all of that. So Luke wasn't just reading anything. Luke was a serious thinker, and he was seriously engaged with what he would regard as struggles. Now, that's important, I think, in understanding what he brought to some of the songs.
Suppose I was already into literature and all that, and you know, so we had a lot in common in that sense, but I learned a lot from him as well, his experience and just you know, being with him and the discussions we would have had with people, I learned an awful lot. Just
like what?
About
to broaden
life.
Broaden,
yeah, it broadened
interest,
my horizon,
yeah,
in many,
yeah,
ways, you know,
yeah,
and all the causes he stood up for. And I mean, I was anti-war, anti-apartheid and anti-nuclear, but Luke actually went out there and he, you know, did something about it, in the sense that he might have performed for a cause or stood up or marched or whatever, you know. So it was, I was very impressed, you know, about his integrity and his strong beliefs.
To whom do we owe our allegiance today? To whom do we owe our allegiance today? To those brave men who fought and died, that Roisin live again with pride. Her sons at home to work and sing, her youth to dance and make her valleys ring. Or the faceless men who for mark and dollar betray her to the highest bidder. To whom do we owe our allegiance today?
He was just a most remarkable fellow. And I remember one time, he used to travel with me in my car. I'd drive to the gigs in Ireland, some of the concerts to do. And my car wasn't the cleanest car in the world. And in the back of my car, in the luggage boot, like, I found a jacket belonging to Luke. I was took the promise up to clean out my car one day, and I was actually taking stuff out with a walking cane. It was also all gone wet and soggy. But I took a jacket of his out and looked at it and held it up, and I just put my hand in the inside pocket, which was soggy, and there was a wad of money in it, you know, which transpired there was 700 or 800 quid in it.
And that would be thousands today, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be a lot of money today.
Yeah.
But Luke
didn't
know
bother him.
No, he didn't
bother him
at all. Nothing bothered Luke.
And then when we went to the Royal Court, I told them for months and months and months that at the Royal Court, if you were Gielgud or Sir Ralph Richardson, everybody got the same money. They didn't believe me. It was 47, some ridiculous money, 47 quid a week.
Basic rate.
Everyone worked for it.
Yeah.
So when they got paid on the Thursday, they said, "Now this joke has gone too far." I said, "When are we getting the readies?" I said, "I've been telling you, you get 47. So every Friday night for those 6 weeks in the Royal Court, there'd be two taxis at the stage door. They'd go off and do an Irish ballroom, and they'd do a gig, and they'd get a grand for the gig.
For the real money.
Yeah, for the real money. So art for art's sake, money for Jesus' sake, they used to say.
Can I give you, just talking about having a sharp mind.
Yeah.
Heckler in an audience can often add another dimension to a show, and a good bit of good humoured banter between stage and audience, you know. But there was this heckler that night. He was just making a nuisance of himself for everybody because he was very drunk and he was interrupting everybody's solo. So it came to Luke's turn anyway. And he shouts up at Luke, "Hey, woolly head." And Luke glares back at him. He said, "At least mine is only woolly on the outside." But there wasn't a geek out of that fella for the rest of the night, you know. What a sharp mind to come out with something just like that, you know.
He was a complex character, you know. Over the years, I have to say that we locked horns, especially in the early days, quite a lot. But there was a common ground as well. I mean, as you were just indicating earlier, he would have spotted something in me as a writer that he could maybe kind of nurture or steer in a particular direction. And equally, I saw something in him that he was more than just a balladeer. You know, I thought, Christ, this is a guy who can really, really breathe life into a song. This is a guy who can make a song work. This is a guy who can bring passion. This is a guy who's got the fire in the belly, you know. And that's special. And I'll tell you something else. I never had to do a second take with Luke Kelly because he sang flat or sharp. Never. Now, that's a little known fact.
You were in the Caribbean last week.
Yeah.
You went through a code red storm to get here to talk to me today. Thank you so much.
I would have gone through hell and high water to talk about Luke Kelly.
I must away now. I can no longer tarry. This morning's tempest I have to cross. I must be guided without a stumble into the arms I love the most. And when he came to his true love's dwelling, he knelt down gently upon a stone and threw